Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. We're here to empower you. We're going to give you the latest on health and nutrition, how women can live a longer life and avoid dementia. We're going to do a commentary from John Whitehead on the rise of the American Imperial President. We're going to have a guest in the second part of our program, Dr. Stephen Jonas. He is a professor emeritus of preventative medicine at Stony Brook University, where he taught for over 45 years. And we're going to talk about the U.S. as a drug culture and public health policies to solve the problem. After all, our entire war on drugs is just, it's failed. Worse than that, because of it, there are hundreds of thousands of dead bodies in Mexico, Guatemala, El Salvador, Colombia, Honduras. That's just in the United States. Oh, and did we forget that little contradiction? The Bush administration, the Obama administration, and the Trump administration have been protecting the warlords in Afghanistan so that their poppy crops could be ever greater. Therefore, they could process that heroin all under the full eye of the and acceptance of the United States government, but then make it illegal when people buy heroin in the United States. Is there anything that is a disconnect with you on that? So we're going to explore that today. Also, continuing with the series that I began a week ago of talking back with reason and with insight and with intellect and with real life experience to those younger people, not all, let's be clear about that, but about 90% of the younger generation who believe that what they are convinced of in the moment and how they feel is all real, and that's the only priority that should exist. And the intolerance now of the left in the liberal community, now coming from a liberal background, but then seeing how it was betrayed, how it was co-opted by the Clintons, that was the beginning of it. And then how it only further codified its intents to convince poor people, working class people, were on your side, all the while doing everything they could to solidify power and wealth in those that would exploit those very same people. The capacity to lie and the media to go along with those lies. No one who has any sense of comport on the larger world, and especially our domestic and foreign policies, could any longer be a part of that. And hence an enormous movement to both an independent status or a progressive status. So we're going to continue talking truth to power. Today, Brendan O'Neill on Identity Politics is Fragile, Needy, and Intolerant. Tomorrow, we're going to have a debate between Paglia and Camille Paglia and Arianna Huffington. You'll hear that on this program. And then we're going to have Leah Sales, a professor of psychology, interviewing a professor of psychology on what has happened to our sense of freedom. So we'll be sharing a lot on these issues, but we always begin with the latest on healing. One of the concerns that many women who are in their 40s or 50s have brought to my attention is that they're seeing their parents who are in their 70s, or 80s, or 60s, beginning to suffer with dementia. And the orthodox protocols have nothing that they can do about it. The worst that happens is that a person goes quickly from dementia into Alzheimer's, but is still otherwise able to function. Look at Ronald Reagan. I mean, if you looked at him walking with his wife, you think, well, he looks pretty good. He's not overweight, seems to have a lot of energy, and indeed he did, except he had completely lost all cognition, suffering from advanced Alzheimer's. There was a point where he didn't even recognize his wife. That is happening to millions upon millions of Americans. That's the people who have the Alzheimer's or dementia. Now think of the tens of millions of Americans who are the sons and daughters of those people suffering. Then you get to, if you're looking at about 5 million people with Alzheimer's, 15 million people with dementia, 100 million people with memory loss, and then everyone they're related to, you're dealing with almost the entire American population. That's how bad it is. Meaning someone in a family, even a millennial, may have a grandfather or grandparent who suffers. So we're talking about not an epidemic, but a pandemic. And we're doing absolutely, positively nothing to reverse it. Oh, there's a lot of research being done, but that's only for the drug. And the drug is not going to reverse anything. So what can we do that is a solution? What is the good news? Well, here's some very good news. I'm going to be introducing you to a couple. She's young. She's, I think, 83. He is 93. And they've been married over, I think, 57 years. In any case, he has been making steady progress. Beginning in October, I'll be working with them again in an intensive in about 3 weeks, for 3 weeks. And at that time, I'll be doing a video with some physicians, including neurologists, who will be taking him through a whole series of tests, all of which you will see, because I'm going to video stream it live, showing you that he has made measurable improvement on all indices, his pulse rate, his heart, his circulation, his blood sugar, his memory, his cognitive powers, all are improving. So, and this is not the first one. There are many before, but this is the one that I'm actually using as an example, because there's never, ever, anywhere in the world been a case where a 93-year-old person with advanced Alzheimer's has reversed it. This could be the first case, or at least make major improvement. So we do have a model that can be used and then do larger clinical, it's for others to do larger clinical studies. I'm just doing that initial study. However, in the summer, this coming summer, I'll be conducting a three-month, it comes in 3 months, then there's 3 months where people are not supervised, then another 3 months where they are, and then another 3 months where they're not, and then we end up with the end of 1 year. Everything with brain, multiple sclerosis, Alzheimer's, dementia, memory loss, everything involving brain. This, more on this study, do not call right now, but it'll be the longest, largest study I've done on the topic, because I believe that we're just not looking in the right places. Let me give you an example. This is in the University of Gothenburg, which is in Sweden. And this was published in the mainstream peer-reviewed journal, the ultimate journal, the highest journal, Neurology. And it's about women who have high physical fitness at middle age, and that can be anywhere from 40 to 50, were nearly 90% less likely to develop dementia decades later compared to women who were moderately fit. And that's important. And this is in the journal of the American Academy of Neurology. So it's not as if this is a secret. It's not as if their neurologists, psychiatrists, are not aware of this, because this measured the women's cardiovascular fitness based upon exercise test. And when the highly fit women did develop dementia, they developed the disease an average of 11 years later than women who were moderately fit. And that meant that where normally you would develop it at, let's say, at 79, you developed at 90. Quote from the study, "These findings are exciting because it's possible that improving people's cardiovascular fitness in middle age could delay or even prevent them from developing dementia." And that's the professor who headed the study at the University of Gothenburg in Gothenburg, Sweden. Now, here's where the monotheistic thought process in science becomes self-limiting. They're looking at just exercise, and they're not looking at interval training, meaning you go out for a power walk. That's easy. and you walk a mile. And for the first month, you walk a mile. Then the second month, you walk 2 miles. Third month, you walk three. You have to do this in a graduating fashion so the body can adapt. And there'll be various levels of fatigue. So you have to have a post-exercise anti-fatigue protocol, which is not difficult. And then you have to measure the person's rest to make sure they're getting rest to compensate for this extra expenditure of the mitochondria, the energy. But what if in the process of that mile, you broke it down into 100-yard sprints, meaning you walk as fast as you can, or you jog as fast as you can, or you bike as fast as you can, for about 60 seconds? Just doing those interval intense exercises in the normal pattern of exercise can also help you slow down the aging process. They didn't do that. Now, what about using diet to also slow down, even reverse damage to the mitochondria, to the energy production, the adenosine triphosphate, that's the actual energy that burns in your cells, wasn't measured. They didn't consider it. What about nutrients we know positively impact dementia, memory loss, and Alzheimer's, such as glycerol phosphorylcholine, phosphatidylserine, acetyl-L-carnitine? And then what about helping the telomeres? Nothing. Well, there are thousands of studies on this. L-carnosine and pycnogenol and resveratrol and NAD. So you see, we have far more clinical experience than any of these scientists in the world, anywhere. And yet you go to an anti-aging science conference, and I've been many times as a keynote speaker, and they're thinking on one single thing to do instead of looking at the whole person. Just remember, anything you introduce into the blood will go through every cell in the body in about 6.5 minutes, except for it may be blocked because of the brain-blood barrier. But anything that's good is helping turn off inflammation everywhere in the body. They're looking just to turn off inflammation in one set of cells with a chemical that can be patented. But if you took beet juice, you're creating nitric oxide for the whole body, increasing circulation to the brain, to the feet, lessening varicosities and spider veins. If you took quercetin, you're helping stopping bruising. You're rebinding collagen. You're getting the synthesis of collagen at an accelerated rate, about 10 times faster than normal. And hence, just by taking in anti-inflammatories to turn off the cytokines, like curcumin, and then using quercetin with vitamin C, you're able to have healthier skin, tighter skin, less wrinkled skin. People look at it and say, have you had Botox? You'll say, no. Why don't you have wrinkles on your forehead and around your eyes? Because I'm supplying my body with the building materials so the collagen can recreate, and I'm hydrating myself, and that is causing a more flushed look and a fuller look. I'm not dehydrated. So when I look at a study like this, a good study, and I commend them for having a good study, now the entire neurological community, because the Bible of that community, has so said, you become physically fit, you have a 90% less likelihood of developing dementia. That is important, but that doesn't mean everyone's then going to stop what they're doing and go out and do this. That's the bad part. But we're more on this on an upcoming program, and look forward to a study, and look forward to about a month from now, over the internet, I'll be streaming it, and I'm also going to stream my evening lectures. And I do a lecture a night for 10 nights, so you'll have a chance to get 10 lectures, all brand new. I've never done them before. All new insights into the human condition, just like overcoming the dark side, love, sexual healing, happiness, anger, taming the beast within. I have about 150 of those. These are 10 new, so you'll have a chance to watch it anywhere in the world. More on that later. This morning, one of our listeners sent me a Leonard Bracken. And sent me a little short video on Laird Hamilton. Now, Laird, if you don't know him, is one of the greatest surfers in history. I mean, he's a legend in history. Phenomenal athlete. Very personable guy also. He's got that it personality where I don't care what he was talking about, you'd find it interesting. Because he's effusive in his enthusiasm for what he does. And this was all about a short video, 5 minutes in his kitchen, where he was being interviewed about his diet. Now, I'll play you the clip. I don't believe our studio in New York has it yet. I sent it, but we're so jammed with work right now because it's one of those unique phenomena. We're the number one progressive radio station in the world. This is the number one program, not to brag or anything, just as a matter of fact. Now suddenly, and we do not know the reason why, hundreds of people want to get on with their programs from all over the world. And so our staff are listening to sample tapes and talking with people all day long. Why didn't they do this a month ago, a year ago, 10 years ago, 15 years ago? Why now? Why is it suddenly in this second, in this moment? Is it the right time, the right place, for the right ideas, for the right support system? Who knows? In any case, it's happening. So I sent up this, and they didn't get back to me yet. But in it, I'll just tell you what it is, and then you can hear it, and we'll go into greater detail. He's on a very high-fat diet, like 80 grams of fat a day. That's a lot of fat. And he's on a lot of caffeine. Now, I don't know how much, but he's talking about these super espressos that he's taking throughout the day. Well, you're looking at anywhere from 400 to 500 milligrams of caffeine per espresso. And then he's adding in butter and adding in oils. Now, the oil is good. It's a coconut oil. And he seems to be very conscious about, you know, that this helps him keep his energy up and helps his brain because the brain's principally made up of fat. So part of what he says is absolutely correct. So he's really trying to do the right thing, and I commend him for that because he's a role model. People will pay attention to him. Certainly surfers will. I know that for a fact because a very close friend of mine, one of my best friends throughout my life, when Latronic, his son Mike, kind of is the person that facilitates almost all the information in news and television and radio stations out of Hawaii on the surfing community. And so this is a big deal in that community. They want to have a longer career, and especially the guy who really made surfing famous now is still around, and he's still competing, and he's still competing at a very high level. So he's saying it's because all this fat that he takes and the caffeine, and he eats a lot of meat, and raw salmon, and these other things, and some vegetables. And he's taking special supplements like this mushroom. He takes it. He says it's the best mushroom in the world. Well, it actually isn't. So I watched it, and I thought, okay, here's what we have. We have a very nice guy who is one of the best competitors in the world, who has been around a long time and still looks terrific, and all that is to his part. But he's gotten misinformation, and what he's actually doing is prematurely aging himself. So with good intent, you can give partial information that's accurate, and especially when you're really driving people onto a keto diet, and that is not healthy. Robert Atkins started that. Bob was a close friend of mine for 25 years until he died. And he and I were friends, but we had completely different of opinion on a vegan plant-based diet versus that high-protein diet. All the science was on the plant-based. Everything it was bad about, and it's proved by the scientific literature, was on his side. So if you should see the, appreciate Mr. Laird for being a phenomenal athlete, but before you duplicate his diet, remember that amount of fat and that amount of caffeine, and caffeine's very close to me because it was one of my doctoral dissertations was on caffeinism. And it was not a simple one. I did clinical studies at the Institute of Applied Biology. I published them in a peer-reviewed literature twice. Very rare do you ever get your thesis published in a peer-reviewed literature. I got it published twice, mainstream journals. And what I showed is, yes, caffeine can increase circulation. Okay. And the coffee bean is loaded with antioxidants, which are good, but that's the coffee bean. That's not the cup of brewed coffee that's high in caffeine, because caffeine is highly anabolic. That's highly acidic. That is a diuretic. That means if you were taking other supplements at the same time you took your caffeine beverage, frequently that'll go right through your system. In fact, I ask this challenge of anyone in the audience who has someone or themselves are still drinking coffee each morning and taking your supplements for a week. And it's not meant to gross you out, but at least after you've finished your movement, check to see if you see any partial or whole supplements in it. Frequently tablets, not capsules, but tablets come right through a person's system undigested. People are not paying attention to this. You should. Also, minerals that are adversely affected by caffeine, potassium, magnesium, zinc, and selenium. Very, very harmful to have those taken out of your body. You could be taking them in, not realizing they're not being absorbed. Also, a lot of people have GERD. Millions of Americans have gastric reflux. And frequently that is due to the high acidity of caffeine. And it also creates a hyperagitation. It's as if you had a five-alarm fire going on all the time when there was no fire. But the alarm was on, and you couldn't turn it off. And then you can't have normal energy unless you have caffeine, which then exhausts the adrenal glands. Should produce normal energy through your adrenals. So I've counseled many athletes, long-distance runners. I've counseled the greatest woman marathon runner in history, Greta Weitz. And these high caffeine intakes can ruin their adrenals. So the energy you have is an artificial energy. And that's way too much fat in the American diet and in the body. That's pro-inflammatory, even though coconut oil in itself is anti-inflammatory. So if he were to say, I take 1 teaspoon of coconut oil, 1 teaspoon of flaxseed oil, I say 1 teaspoon of olive oil, good for you. Eating raw salmon? No. Where are you going to find healthy salmon today when Fukushima has polluted the entire Pacific Ocean? Where? And you're going to run the risks of worms, parasites that are in raw fish? Not a good idea. So I'm going to send a letter out to him and explaining what I think he's doing correctly, some things he is, and what I believe that he should do more research. Just something to share with you. But anyhow, there's a new study out of Northwestern University that talks about caffeine, quote, the coffee-cannabis connection. And it talks about how people feel more energized, but after you drink coffee, that's true, or a cola, that's also true. But the coffee's affecting your metabolism in dozens of ways, including your metabolism of steroids and the neurotransmitters typically linked to cannabis. The difference is when cannabis is used, it is matching the normal receptors in the brain and hence allowing for a calming effect. Caffeine does not have a calming effect, just the opposite. But also caffeine can block some of those metabolite receptor areas. And by the way, just so you understand, metabolites are chemicals in the blood that change after we eat and drink for a variety of other reasons. And the neurotransmitters, neuro, N-E-U-R-O, that means your brain, transmitters related to the the endocannabinoid system, the same ones affected by cannabis. They decreased after drinking 4 or more cups of coffee a day, and that's the opposite of what occurs when someone uses cannabis. And neurotransmitters are the chemicals that deliver messages between nerve cells. And the cannabinoids are the chemicals that give the cannabis plant its medicinal and recreational properties. The body also naturally produces endocannabinoids, which mimic cannabinoid activity. In addition, certain metabolites related to the what are called androsteroid system increased after drinking 4 cups of coffee a day, which suggests coffee can facilitate the excretion or even elimination of steroids. You don't want that, because the steroid pathway is a focus for certain diseases, including cancers. So now the question is, could drinking a lot of coffee increase the prevalence of cancer? I can tell you, detoxifying people off coffee is not a quick or easy thing. You got to abstain for about a month before you start rebalancing your blood metabolites and of the endocannabinoid system. So just remember, a lot of reasons not to consume caffeine. Also, a new study from Indiana University as well as the University of California, San Francisco showed that there is a link between glyphosate to shortened pregnancy lengths. That is not good. This unique study was performed by scientists from the Indiana University Fairbanks School of Public Health as well as Indiana School of Medicine. And the study's conclusions, quote, this is the first study of glyphosate, that's that Monsanto's fertilizer, the Roundup, exposure in U.S. pregnant women using urine specimens as a direct measure of exposure. We found that 90% of pregnant women had detectable glyphosate levels and that these levels correlated significantly with shortened pregnancy lengths, end quote. You want full-length pregnancy. You do not want something artificially shortening it. And so that is the latest on health and healing. I'm Gary Nall. Tomorrow I'm going to talk about how a new study out of San Diego State University finds alcohol really adversely affects your brain waves, and that is affecting your decision-making capability. Also tomorrow, I'll talk about how adenoviruses are often acting like flu. They have the same symptoms, but it's far less deadly. So how many people who claim they had the flu actually had the virus instead? We're 27 minutes into our program. We're going to take a brief break and come right back. Please stay with us. We have Elizabeth on hold right now before we go to our guest in a few moments. Let's say hello to Elizabeth. She takes all your questions. And you can ask questions or make statements or share information by going to prnstudio@gmail.com. prnstudio@gmail.com. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi, Gary. Here is a letter from a lady who is really appreciating the series you're doing to show the dangers of identity politics and the misdirection of the newest feminist movement. Her good friend was Barbara Seaman, who is one of the leading second wave feminists. She co-authored a book with you that she called For Women Only, that this lady feels is one of the most important books ever written. She says, likely Barbara didn't tell you this, but she considered you like a son, and the two of you had the most interesting conversations, especially when on tour together. But she never laughed so hard. You were very funny all the time. She also appreciated the radicalism of Paglia, who took on the self-serving feminists of Gloria Steinem, who she considered were narcissists. And but Barbara chose to be more diplomatic. And as her friend, this lady says, she knows that she held them, most of them, in contempt, that they were not deep thinkers. Anyway, the lady says, please keep the series going. We need it. I just celebrated my 89th birthday and am as healthy as can be because of you. So that was nice of her.
And then that's nice.
And then we've got a question from a... Sorry.
Go ahead.
Okay. We've got a question from a guy called Howard. He says he used to run, he did 10 marathons over the years and then stopped as he had some injuries and he didn't want to cause more injuries to himself. He used to run by the Natural Living and Walking Club every Sunday in Central Park for years. But he didn't stop to listen to what you were saying. He asked, what's the difference between what your message was and the other running clubs? And was there ever a time to stop? Is there ever a time to stop running a marathon, as most people do no more than about 2, whereas you did over 80? And he's asking, have you stopped, and why have you stopped?
Well, there's several different questions there. First, to Barbara Seaman, she was one of the most enjoyable conversationalists that I had ever met in my life, and I was very fortunate. She was much older than me, but she also was a person who had the capacity to sit and listen to many different points of view without aligning with any one, but allowing everyone to have their say. Whether she agreed or disagreed, she was more apt to be polite and thoughtful. And as a result, a lot of people like Barbara. She was not a firebrand, and she was not a narcissist. She did not draw attention to herself unduly, and her books have withstood the test of time. She was one of the leading voices, along with Betty Friedan and others, in the second wave of feminism. We're now in the third wave of feminism. And she also, we had a conversation once about Paglia, and she liked Paglia. She didn't agree with everything she said, but she liked her because Paglia is one of those people who just gets right in your face and tells you what she believes. You could agree or disagree with her. On many things I agree, many things I don't. Tomorrow, in fact, we're going to have a debate between Paglia and also the former developer of a major post and who was actually a part of the feminist movement, and then she dropped out, Arianna Huffington, and then she went against feminism, and then they'll give the reasons why. You'll hear that debate tomorrow on this program. I think you'll find it interesting. In any case, there was a great deal of intolerance of anyone, any woman, who did not follow the guidelines that were established for what was politically correct at that time. So along came Madonna in the 80s and into the 90s, who broke with that pattern and started emphasizing sexual liberation and honoring the full femininity and sexuality of the female being, where there was one group of feminists who believed in the spiritual feminism and another group who believed in purely the polemic. And many of those were just male haters. So you had three different schools, and each one for a period of time had some foothold into the American consciousness. How much they caused in the way of actual change of minds, there's no way of measuring that. But at least they were important. In my opinion, the feminist movement was as important to liberating females as the suffragettes, the people who were the abolitionists, the people who fought against slavery. Each of those were important and essential movements, and liberating the American female so that she could live a full and equal life, with the freedom to make her own choices and determine her own future, and as an equal in all respects. That was the significance of the second generation, the second wave of feminism, of which Barbara Seaman was a member, and I was privileged to be able to be her friend. And also, she asked me one day, could we write a book together? And it took us 2 years, but we wrote one of the most definitive books. In fact, I'll tell you a little interesting story. We were going to have a book signing, introduced the book to the public. And we selected the Barnes & Noble at 82nd and Broadway. And normally with a book signing, it's always packed. You might have 200 people, maybe 300. And that night, we couldn't get enough people into the store, meaning there was no room. In fact, Barbara decided to introduce some of the outstanding feminists in America who were there for the book signing. There were 54 of them. 54. So she would do like a 3 or 4 minute introduction to, here, over here, we have such and such, and this is her background. She's the author of this. it took us 2 hours just to introduce the feminist in the room, and plus all the people downstairs, out the street, down the block. We estimated over 1,300 people came to that. That is a big thing, and that's really the responsibility of Barbara, because these were people she knew and were her close friends that she had worked with. And that's what it meant to be a diplomat. That's what it meant to be an ambassador for cooperation and honest, ethical, and open communication between differing points of view. Very few people had the capacity to do that. She did. And now we could use another Barbara Seaman today. Anyhow, that said, there was a day when I was doing a New York City marathon, and I was coming across the 59th Street Bridge with John Q, and there were about 30 of us running together. We've had as many as 100 of us running at the same pace together. And it's always an exhilarating experience. First of all, just the camaraderie of all the other athletes. And many of these athletes you see on a daily basis training in Central Park or on a Sunday when we'd stop and have meetings. Now, ours was a different club, is a different club, still exists. The Natural Living and Running and Walking Club is based upon not just training your body to do 26 miles, but also liberating your thought process to understand that you've got to train on all levels. So we're the groups that are the vegans, that do the juicing, that take the special supplements. We bring articles in the scientific literature to share with people each week so they understand why they're taking something, why you take magnesium before workout to prevent a heart attack, why you take L-carnitine to prevent a heart attack, why you take coenzyme Q to prevent a heart attack. So others are not taking it. They are thinking, if I can run a marathon, my heart's great. Well, lesson, Jim Fix, Olympian, died, and I ran with Jim from a heart attack. He was thin, but he didn't have a good diet, and he didn't understand his biochemistry. So we also are the ones that do the meditations. We do deep thought on important topics. So we're the kind of a holistic group, the only one of its kind in America. And we've trained over 30,000 people in our group free as a public service every Sunday. When I'm in the city, every Sunday we're there at Center Park, 90th Street, and who've finished the New York City Marathon, plus some of the greatest elite runners today in the world. Thelma Wilson, one of the best. Sam Skinner, you know, Sid Howard, and lots more. But on that day that I crossed the 59th Street Bridge, I just asked myself, why am I doing this? I don't even know how many I've done. One person, our archivist, told me I did 81. Someone else said I've done 28 New York marathons. I have no idea. All I know is on that day I realized there was no purpose just to keep doing it. Did you ever watch the movie Forrest Gump?
Yes, yeah.
Okay, there's a scene in Forrest Gump where he's running across, and he's got a beard, and all these people are running.
Yeah.
And then he just stops. And everyone says, what are you stopping? And then he just went to the next part of his life. There's a time when we have to close a chapter in our life in order to open up a new chapter. We have to stop the patterns of behavior, even if we've adapted to them, even if there's something we gain from them. There's a photograph up on my website. Jay put it up there, I think, last week or the week before. It shows a picture of Sam Skinner and myself shaking hands, and to give it context, you ought to take another look at it. Sam had won the gold medal in the Jamaica Marathon. I won a gold medal in the Jamaica Marathon. We both won golds, and that was a grueling race, the toughest marathon I've ever done in my life, the worst course. Terrible planning for it down there. There was no water for 18 miles for us. There was thunderstorms. We were running with rats running across the water and up to our knees. No signs, so we got off course 2 to 3 times. You couldn't imagine. They never allowed another marathon down there after that one. It was so badly done that. But we finished, and everyone in our group that went down finished. But that was... That was one of those highlights that you will never forget. What you went through to finish a race and win the Jamaica Marathon, Sam and I. It's just a picture. You just see a picture. You don't realize what went into it, the training that went into it, the commitment, the discipline. But there's a time where you have to then say, okay, I put my discipline and commitment, and I've gained something from this. I've shared it with others. Let me go on and master something else now. So it's realizing, don't stay forever in the same place, even if it's comfortable and predictable, because you're missing out on other things you could also do. So that's when I decided that was my last marathon at that time. I will start marathoning again and the World Games again in 2 years. And when I hit another milestone, 5-year milestone, then I'm going to compete for a whole year for marathons and the World Games. So we've got to stop even things we like and reposition for the next chapter. Appreciate what we have, what we've experienced, and realize there are new people you can experience things with. All those people, when I see their faces, those grueling workouts we did in my apartment for 20 years every Monday night, where we'd run up the steps 25 times and then run in the park for 12 miles, come back and work each one of us on curls, 80 curls, 100 curls with heavy weights, doing 500 sit-ups each. That was not an easy workout, but that's what created champions, that commitment and the camaraderie. You know, you became friends with these people. And now you think, okay, I haven't spoken to these people in a long time. Wonder what's happened to them. There's a Catherine Kiggins I saw a photograph of, and Susan Clements. Where are they at now? Are they still training? Are they still racing? How they look? And you wonder about those things. At least I do. Because you always wish for the best for nice people, and you hope they continue with the next chapter. But when we're in a chapter, when we're doing something, we don't realize how tenuous, how that will pass. Are we prepared to let something go and appreciate that we had the experience and was around people that we liked doing it? Whatever it is. So that's why I haven't raced in a marathon. I'm racing. Just won a state championship a few weeks ago. But I'm not doing marathons because it would be a distraction from my other things that I'm occupying my time with. Hope that answered your question.
Yes. Excuse me. Sorry. Yes, that's great. Thank you.
Good. Okay. We're going to go to our guests in just about 3 minutes, and that is going to be an important interview. But let me also mention that we have a special for people, and I was asked, would I give this special? I'd be happy to. It's an immune shield special, meaning it's immune stuff and sleep stuff. It's normally $173, it's $112, so it's a big discount. I take the immune stuff every day, 12 months a year. When I go on the road, as I am now, you bet I take a lot of it. I take cans and I open up and put them in big zipper bags, and then I just add spring water or filtered water wherever I'm at, and I can go a long time. What's an immune stuff? Why did I create it? First of all, because I care that most people don't know what to eat or drink to stimulate their immune system on a consistent basis. When you consider that inactivity or too much activity, work, relationships, our environment, all can create undue amounts of stress. So this is my way of contributing something that if you just take this in your regular shake in the morning, maybe throw this in with your green stuff, red stuff, but it's immune stuff. I put the organic maitake mushroom and the organic shiitake mushroom and the organic reishi mushroom, plus the Argaricus blase mushroom and acai and strawberries and oranges and goji and mango and apple and orange and with stevia. And that's it. It's vegan. And this is blended, mixed in order to impact you at the most functional level in the best way possible. Who should use it? Just about everyone. I mean, this is really super good. Then I have sleep stuff. Why? Because, well, guess what we're lacking a lot of in our society? And there are a lot of reasons for that. But no matter what the reason, there's a lot that you can do. And this is one of the things you can use in your armamentarium towards getting a better night's sleep. I put together a special blend of passion flower extract, valerian extract, chamomile extract, ashwagandha extract, melatonin, L-theanine, hops, reishi, lipase, amylase, protease, inulin, jasmine tea, stevia, Gryphmia extract, GAB extract, 5-hydroxytryptophan, lemon balm, skullcap, catnip. Yeah. There's never been a formula that I could think of or know of in the world that is as comprehensive, all-inclusive, delicious, vegan. It's called Sleep Stuff. So you're getting them both. Two together. Immune Stuff, Sleep Stuff. For only $112, you're saving over, what, $50? So all you have to do is just call the number. Now, in a moment here, I'm going to give you the number that you call. And it's 877-627-5065. You're getting two products, Sleep Stuff and Immune Stuff, the best of the best. Call 877-627-5065. 877-627-5065. Back in a moment with my guest. Please stay with us. I'd like to welcome you from all over the world and all of our syndicated stations for tuning in today. My guest is Dr. Steve Jonas, J-O-N-A-S. As I mentioned at the beginning of the program, he is Professor Emeritus of Preventive Medicine at Stony Brook University, where he has taught since 1971. It's a long tenure. He's the author of 35 books, lots of articles in academic journals, and he also publishes on Op-Ed News and the Greenville Post, and he addresses national public health policies on wellness. He is also a contributing editor to the Political Junkies for Progressive Democracy magazine, and he is a graduate from Harvard University and Yale University Medical Schools, as well as the Wagner School at New York University. Nice to have you with us today.
Great to be with you, Gary, and you and I have known each other for such a long time. Nice to be back on the air with you.
Well, how many times have you driven in Central Park, ridden in Central Park, and there we were,
raining and running? Sunday morning at 9 o'clock at Engineer's Gate.
That's decades, over, well, let's see, over 45 years, so that's
something
not bad.
Like that.
We've covered frequently the failure of the government's war on drugs, which for a while seemed to be losing some steam, but now has a huge uptick with the with the Trump administration and Jeff Sessions as Attorney General. There are two issues regarding his history I'd like you to delve into.
Sure.
First is the broader, more socio-psychological issue that the U.S. is a drug culture, and we have been a drug culture for a long time. From an early age, children are taught how to take pills and drugs. It's completely acceptable. It's acceptable to label a kid as ADHD or hyperactive, even if there is no physiological measurement to prove that. And if it's not legal medication, then it's illegal ones. Either way, we are into it. But then we don't ask ourselves, when we're arresting people and damaging their reputations and their lives, why did you want the drugs to begin with? We never get to that level of the conversation because I believe it would turn a mirror on the conscience of America and show us to be unprepared to answer that question. Why do we need this amount of drugs? And why aren't we putting a battle on understanding our needs, our cravings, the addictive process, and then the cost of that emotionally to our families and friends and society, and work in a non-invasive and non-corporal way to resolve the issues? The forum is yours.
Absolutely, Gary. I mean, you and I have been in agreement on this issue, on this matter for a long time. The so-called drug war is an artificial approach to the problem of the use of what I call the recreational mood-altering drugs, the RMADs. Mm-hmm. There's a whole group of them, in terms of their harm to society, The most harmful one is nicotine in tobacco products. The second most harmful one is ethyl alcohol and alcoholic beverages. Those are both, both of course, are entirely legal. There are certain limitations on age, and now, fortunately, with cigarettes, where one can use them, et cetera, et cetera. But the point is, those are the two most harmful ones. Cigarettes, cigarette smoke is still killing 488,000 people a year. 488,000 people a year. Of that number, about 50,000 people a year die who have never smoked, who were subjected to secondhand smoke in restaurants, bars, workplaces, etc. This number is going to go down gradually over the coming years because we have had the most successful public health approach to the drug problem in the National Smoking Cessation Program, which has been underway since the first Surgeon General's report on smoking and health in 1964. And we are now down to about 18% of the adult population smoking. However, that still means that in 30 to 40 years, we will be having only somewhere between 150,000 to 200,000 deaths a year from tobacco. Now, nevertheless, that public health approach has been very successful. What has not been successful in dealing with drug use is the drugs that are the recreational mood-altering drugs that are artificially labeled as illegal, and it's entirely artificial. The so-called drug war has done virtually nothing over its close to 40 years of existence, 50 years of existence, in terms of reducing the drugs which it is aimed, namely marijuana, heroin, and cocaine, and more lately methamphetamine. You ask why do we do this? The modern drug war was begun by under Richard Nixon in the early 1970s, and in a remarkable confession, as it were, by one of his former top two aides, John Ehrlichman, in a book that he wrote after he came out of prison for his role in Watergate, he said he had this to say. I'm quoting or reading here. Look, we understand we couldn't make it illegal to be young or poor or black in the United States, but we could criminalize their common pleasure. We understood that drugs were not the health problem we were making them out to be, but it was such a perfect issue that we couldn't resist it. Nixon emphasized that you have to face the fact that the whole problem really is really the blacks. The key is to devise a system that recognizes this while not appearing to. The drug war in terms of dealing with drug use, which can be damaging, certainly I think we all agree to that. Nevertheless, it has been a total failure. It has been a major success in terms of locking up people of color, in terms of supporting both the state-operated prisons and the private prison industry, in terms of removing large numbers of young people of color, mainly male, from the streets and from the workplace. Getting to the point, so my book, which is called, we're talking about my, plug my book here, Gary. It's called Ending the Drug War, Solving the Drug Problem, The Public Health Approach. What my book does, which differentiates it from the other legalizers, is first of all, it looks at the whole range of recreational mood-altering drugs, not just marijuana and not just focusing on the legalization of marijuana. I think that the legalization of marijuana is a fine idea. Marijuana is probably the least harmful in the population sense of any of the recreational mood-altering drugs. That's fine. But legalizing marijuana doesn't solve the drug problem. the drug problem that we have, as I said at the beginning, begins with the use of tobacco products and the deaths that it causes. The drug problem then encompasses also the 85,000 deaths a year from alcohol, the toll of drunk driving accidents and death, the fact that in 50% of murders, alcohol is present either in the perpetrator or the victim or both. So alcohol is a very dangerous substance. We tried, of course, everybody knows about prohibition. We tried prohibition back in the 1920s, didn't work, discarded it. And now, you know, for the last 50 years, we've essentially been doing the same thing.
So, okay, Steve, let me interject here. Because
sure. I'm talking to you. Sorry, Gary.
No, that's all right. Your facts are absolutely spot on. And I also believe that we should be taking people out of prison and expunging their records so that they can rehabilitate within society without being prejudiced. I also believe that much of our war on drugs is racist-based.
Absolutely.
But the larger question...
Ehrlichman admitted that in that quote I just
yes,
read.
Yes, but others haven't read that quote, and others in subsequent generations and administrations continue to use the misguided principle that somehow everything's a gateway drug leading to something worse. Here's what we're not talking about. Now, I would like you to wrap your thoughts around this, please. Why would we be drinking or smoking or doing any drug if we had a happy, balanced life? What's missing in the American lifestyle, belief system, or psyche that is creating this need for something to take its place?
Well, I think one thing is a factor that's very important in that, Gary. I mean, we could look at the whole, you know, the whole society and societal problems that lead people to using the recreational mood altering drugs. But we can also look at the role of the industries that produce those drugs, and that includes the pharmaceutical industry. And I'm not just talking about the production of OxyContin, et cetera, et cetera. I'm talking about the fact that in this country, little kids are exposed to the message that if you chew on this jelly drop, which has vitamins in it, it's going to make you a better person. People, children, and as they grow up, people are being, for decades, have been fed, literally, this message that if you take a drug, it will make you better. We have advertising of drugs for children. We have the beer industry spends $2 billion a year on advertising. I have never been a beer drinker because I think the taste of the stuff is awful. There has to be a reason why people drink beer, and one of them is because it's pushed mightily by the alcohol industry. We have major controls on advertising for tobacco, but the alcohol industry lobby is so powerful that nothing is ever going to happen on advertising alcohol. So these drugs are pushed by the industries. Then, additionally, the United States is one of only two countries in the world where prescription drugs are advertised on television. And you see that two of them, you know, you watch television, two of the major advertisers on television are, on the one hand, the automobile industry, and on the other hand, the pharmaceutical industry. The only other country in the world that allows the advertising of prescription medications on television is New Zealand. Why New Zealand does it, I have absolutely no idea. But it's done in this country because the pharmaceutical industry is so powerful. And by the way, the president who gave the final approval to that to that system of advertising of pharmaceutical drugs was none other than Bill Clinton. So we live in a society, we live in a drug culture. And I think that has to be recognized if we want to deal with the drug problem. Of course, I absolutely agree with you with the statement you made just before about racism being a major factor in the drug war. It was in the past. It still is. And if Sessions gets his way, it's going to become that way again.
Thank you. And there's a lot more, in fact, a tremendous amount of good material. And in The Drug War, Solving the Problem, The Public Health Approach, by my guest, Dr. Steve Jones. And you can get it at your local bookstore. Stephen,
well,
thank you for being on today.
You can't really get it at your local bookstore. You can get it on Amazon, Gary.
Okay.
And you can get it either as an e-book, or you can get it in a hardcover book. There are two different entries on Amazon.
Great.
Under my name, Ending the Drug War, Solving the Drug Problem, The Public Health Approach.
I look forward to another conversation with you, Steve.
Thank you, and I look forward to seeing you. When are you going to be getting back out at Engineers Gate on Sunday mornings, Gary?
About 4 weeks from now. I'll be there for about 3 months, all right?
Okay, good. We'll see you then. And
Take care. Thanks
so much for having me on the air, Gary. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Have a wonderful day, everyone, and I look forward to being back here sharing more with you tomorrow.
I know everybody realizes that a man works better when he works out his own bag. Can you understand that? I can understand that.